Good morning. You've probably been watching the news a little bit this week, or maybe you haven't. but if you have been watching the news, this week has been a week of legal precedent. There has been a lot of debate over certain policies, and I'm not going to get into the exact nature of those policies, but there's been a lot of debate about that, and it's been heard before the Supreme Court this week. There's also been a lot of other policies that have been taking place and things that maybe have played second fiddle to some of these other Supreme Court decisions that have been occurring. One of the precedents that has been established this week is that a government agency known as the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia has started gathering a list of religious dissenters. And that has already been used as a legal pretext to gather lists in a lot of other places. I'll give an example of that. And it's been specifically for religious dissenters. That has been the key criteria for that. My sister is an air traffic controller, so she works basically as a government contractor for the FAA. And she had to sign paperwork identifying what her religious disagreement was, where her religious ties are, what her beliefs are. And she had to sign that and submit that. Now, you may have a variety of different opinions on something, but that does not seem like a good idea, in the least, to create a list of religious dissenters, especially when it says we can do whatever we want to with this information on the paperwork that was given to my sister. Again, you may have a variety of different thoughts or opinions on that, but that just does not seem like a good legal precedent. It was for a few hundred years in our country that this was not biblically called this, but it was called a Christian nation. and we sort of used that as a badge of honor. And we said that our country is not like anybody else's. And for a long time, that was true. But we've talked also theoretically, and we've talked about how that will not always be the case. It never is with any nation. And we are at the point where lists are being collected, which, again, is not a good legal precedent. And that means that the tide is turning. That means that religious beliefs are now a test by which you meet government approval or not under the threat of penalty. That's not good. We are at a turning point in our country. And you need to seriously ask yourself if you are ready for something like that. In John chapter 15, Jesus talked to his disciples before he was to be crucified. He talked about some of the things that they would face. In John 15, starting in verse 18, he says, "If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. They kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know the one who sent me. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. He who hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would not have sin. But now they have both seen and hated me, and my Father as well. But they have done this to fulfill the word that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. When the Helper comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, that is the Spirit of truth who proceeds from the Father, he will testify about me, and you will testify also because you have been with me from the beginning." 16, verse 1. "These things I have spoken to you so that you may be kept from stumbling. They will make you outcasts from the synagogue. But an hour is coming for everyone who kills you to think that he is offering service to God. These things they will do because they have not known the Father or me. But these things I have spoken to you so that when their hour comes, you may remember that I told you of them. These things I did not say to you at the beginning, because I was with you." Jesus was preparing his disciples and saying, yes, there will be a time very soon where you will be hated and you will be killed. And you will be killed by people who think that they're rendering service to me, but they're not. This was, of course, fulfilled under the Roman Empire in its most specific fulfillment. There was a period of about 300 years after this where Christians were indeed killed. They were martyred for the faith. Even people like Polycarp, who was in his 80s, was killed for the faith. But you see that it finds fulfillment in a lot of other periods in history, too. The Middle Ages and the Dark Ages. And even during the Reformation, and even during the Restoration, you see this constant refrain of people dying for the faith, people dying for their beliefs. And it has been a little while for us in this country to undergo something like this, but the tide is changing. And I thought that it would be prudent, in light of this tide changing, to talk about how God stepped in one particular scenario, where one of his people, one of his followers, one of his children, was killed for the faith. One was arrested and one was destined to be killed, but he was delivered. And so part of this discussion that we're having this morning deals with the goodness of God in light of these circumstances where you have some Christians being arrested, being killed, and you have others who are released. Throughout its earliest days, the church suffered persecution at the hands of a lot of different authorities. They suffered death at the hands of religious authorities. They suffered death at the hands of political authorities. And we're going to talk about Acts chapter 12 this morning and how the civil authorities in the early church took up a sword against the believers and what sorts of things occurred during this time period. In Acts chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2, we see the death of the first apostle. Now, all the apostles will be martyred with the exception of John. John lives to be very old, probably close to about 100 years old. John lives, definitely an exception, but he is the exception to the rule. Most of the apostles die within about 30 to 40 years of the inception of Christianity. Some are filleted alive, some are beheaded, some are thrown off of the temple, some are drugged behind horses. They go through all manner of ungodly deaths and torments. James is beheaded. In Acts chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. So a few things we note here. He laid hands on some Christians. That's typically how persecution happens. It starts with some Christians. And then some Christians turns into all Christians. So you may think to yourself, well, I don't share this viewpoint that's being persecuted right now. It starts with some Christians and then it goes to all Christians. This is Herod Agrippa I who is doing this. He was the grandson of Herod the Great. Herod the Great was the one who sought to kill the infant Jesus and slaughtered at least several dozen male children in the city of Bethlehem, the town of Bethlehem. He is at the zenith of his power, Herod Agrippa I, and he is living in the utmost magnificence, just like his grandfather. And just like his grandfather, he is cruel and he is treacherous. He is a snake, and you do not want to have to deal with Herod Agrippa I. Now, what prompted his oppositions to the saints is not particularly revealed. It just says he started laying hands on the saints. It doesn't say necessarily why. But his intent is clear. He set out to afflict some of the church, or certain of the church, if you're using the King James Version. And the word afflict here, there's several words for afflict in the New Testament. The word afflict here is the word for beating. He wanted to beat the Christians in a physical sense. He wanted to beat and pummel them. And James, one of those Boanerges guys, one of those Boanerges sons of thunder, the brother of John, James dies first, John will die last. James, the brother of John, becomes the first apostle to die for the faith. And he's not the first believer to die for his faith. Stephen had been stoned several chapters earlier, but he is the first apostle to die for the faith. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. With the sword suggests that James was beheaded. During the short time before his death, James might have remembered the Lord's word in Matthew 20 and verses 22 through 23, where Jesus says that they will share in the baptism of suffering that he underwent. They did. James suffered in the sense of physical death, being murdered. John would suffer in the sense of watching all of his brethren get killed. How soon it seems for one to pass from the scene. Why was James allowed to die? But Peter will be delivered. Did not God have the power to deliver James? Yes. But he didn't. And ultimately, the battleground at this division in our hearts that happens when some are delivered and some are not, the answer lies in the counsels of God. And that's not a cop-out. It's just a recognition and a realization, a high estimation of the fact that God has bigger plans than we could ever realize. Both of these men, James and Peter, lived in faith. James would not have been arrested had he been disloyal to the faith. But some are delivered and some are not. In Hebrews chapter 11, Hebrews 11, it speaks of many, many, many who did great and wonderful things, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release, but that they would obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, beatings. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two. They were tempted, they were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground, all of these having gained approval for their faith. Some died in horrible persecution, and others did not. In the time of Nero, there's a Roman historian who speaks of how Nero would actually take the skins and the meat of slaughtered animals, and he would tie them around Christians, and he would have them run in his garden, and they would be attacked and destroyed and eaten. That same Roman historian talks about how he would douse people with flammable materials and light them aflame, and he would use them as lamps for his garden parties. If the world hated me, it will hate you also. If the world kills me, it will kill you also. Both of these men, Peter and John, lived in faith. James was not delivered. And in the days of persecution ahead, some Christians will be delivered and some will not. So be prepared. As we continue in this narrative in Acts chapter 12 and verses 3 through 4, when Herod Agrippa saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. And that should make you think that time period to similar days in which Jesus was killed. When he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. Herod intended to kill Peter when? After Passover. And that should sound familiar because that was the original plan with Jesus. We will arrest him, and we will kill him after the Passover. Herod was careful to please the Jews on one hand, but also not to create a disturbance that would create more of a headache for himself. That was the same exact idea they had with Jesus, but the situation changed, and they changed with it. Mark chapter 14, verses 1 and 2 point out that Jesus was destined for death after the Passover, but they had an opportunity because of Judas's betrayal to do it in the night hours so nobody could see. He was condemned illegally during the evening hours and the early morning hours, and he was killed. It appears Herod was going to make a public spectacle of the proceedings to further his own ends. That's the sort of person that we are dealing with here. In verse 5, so Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. If God allowed James to die, it makes you think that Peter's about to die as well. And the saints don't know what God is going to do, so they pray fervently on his behalf. And that's all they really can do. I mean, they're not going to take machine guns down to the prison and try to get Peter out, nor should they. Those who live by the sword shall die by the sword. But they pray. We don't have a lot of the content of their prayer. It's not like it's laid out for us word for word. But one of the things that you might think about is they may not have prayed for him to be released. They may not have had any reason to expect that, given what happened with James. Nevertheless, they prayed for him, and they prayed that he would remain strong. Now, later on, we get a little bit more about this prayer. Continuing on in Acts chapter 12, they weren't really expecting it. When Peter shows up at the door, in chapter 12, verse 14, where this servant girl, Rhoda, comes to answer the door, when she recognized Peter's voice because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. And what did they say to her? They said to her, "You are out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. They kept saying, "It is his angel." They had no reason to expect that Peter would get out of prison. They expected him to be martyred, just like James. And Peter needed the prayers of his brethren to remain strong. And those who are starting to be persecuted today need the prayers of those who are not being persecuted today. What a difference prayers make. The praying church was pitted against the vexations of Herod Agrippa. Never underestimate the power of prayer. The prayer of a righteous person availeth much. Sometimes in our society today, when we say things like, "We'll pray for you," people scoff at that idea and they say, "Well, why don't you actually do something for me?" The most important thing that we can do for somebody is pray. And that doesn't exempt us from taking action where we can take action in other ways. But prayer is powerful if we would pray in faith. You do not have because you do not ask, James 4 tells us. Right before in James chapter 5 telling us that prayer is effective, he says you don't have because you don't ask. And the angel will deliver Peter. Starting in verse 6, Acts chapter 12, on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, "Get up quickly." And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so, and he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow, and he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. It's interesting that Paul and Barnabas have this debate about John Mark and whether John Mark is reliable or not. At the end of Peter's life, in 2 Peter chapter 3, he talks about his intimate connection with John Mark. This is years later. This is like 30 years after this. Him and John Mark and that family had stayed intimately connected. That's beautiful to think about. When all of this happens, what is Peter doing when the angel breaks him free? Have you ever paid attention to that? He is sleeping. You ever been in prison? You ever been in jail? Probably not a lot of us, but maybe some of us. Not the easiest place to fall asleep in. Peter was sleeping. Makes me think of Jesus on the boat. There's this storm and everybody's panicking and we're all going to die. Master, don't you care about us? And Jesus is sleeping. Peter was sleeping in the jail cell. Not in a little cot, chained to two soldiers. He was sleeping. What a picture of trust in God. Peter had the Lord's promise, so he did not have to be concerned about what defense he offered. He said the Holy Spirit would give him what he had to say. In Matthew 10 and verse 19, Peter had confidence in the Lord. In light of the turning tide, how confident are you in the Lord? How strong is your faith? Are you ready to persevere? Are you ready to be faithful until death? Which in perhaps my lifetime will be a reality. Peter was well guarded, chained to two guards in front of him. Now, the apostles had been released earlier, but it wasn't as serious at that point. In Acts chapter 4, Peter and John were released and warned, "Don't speak in the name of Jesus anymore, you'll get beaten." In Acts chapter 5, they do. They get beat and they get released. And they rejoice because they could suffer for the faith, it says in Acts chapter 5. Herod was taking no chances at this time. He had guard after guard after guard. He had Peter under lockdown. And God accepted Herod's challenge. God waited until the last night. I don't know exactly the timeline of this, but I would imagine that Herod Agrippa wasn't going to wait for very long after the Passover to kill Peter. It may be that this very night was the Passover. And the very next day, he was going to be killed. Do you remember when Jesus was killed? It was on Passover. God waited until the last night. It doesn't say how long Peter was in prison, but it says that he was in prison until the last night, on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward. That's what verse 6 tells us. Sometimes God will allow us to be pushed right to the edge, and then he'll pull us back from the edge. That's not because he's capricious. That's not because he revels in our torment. That is an effort to expand and develop ourselves. Because perseverance and endurance produce great fruit. Peter goes to the house of Mary, John Mark's mother, which ties everything together. The Gospel of Mark and Peter and 2 Peter mentioning John Mark, Acts mentioning John Mark, and the debate between Paul and Barnabas, it ties it all together. Peter goes to the house of Mary where people were praying, where his brethren were praying. What did Peter want to do? Get out of Dodge as soon as possible? And the first thing he wanted to do was go to his brethren and say, your prayers have been answered. The house of Mary must have been a normal meeting place. Somebody asked me recently how people met back in my day, right? No cell phones. How did people meet? He said, he's a young guy, younger than me. How did people meet? And I mentioned a few different ways that we could get together back in the day. Peter knew to go to Mary's house because that's where they met. It was normal to meet there. And this whole Rhoda situation, there's a touch of humor here. Peter's knocking on the door, right? And he's like, hey, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. And Rhoda doesn't even open the door. She gets so excited, she forgets to open the door. They may not have been praying for his release. Maybe they were. But they were at the very least praying for his, for him to be faithful. Even so, the amazement and the unbelief may have come from the method and timing rather than doubt about God's power or willingness. And having wrestled with weakness of faith in our own lives, we are poor judges to cast stones at these brethren whose prayer meeting in the middle of the night was broken up by Peter's unexpected arrival. Herod, obviously, very angry about this situation. Let's pick up in verse 15. They said to her, Rhoda, you are out of your mind. But she kept insisting that it was so. They kept saying it is his angel or his ghost. But Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioned to them with his hand to be silent. He described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison, and he said, report these things to James and the brethren. James, Jesus' brother at this point. Then he left and went to another place. Now when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. When Herod had searched for him and had not found him, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away to execution. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Very, very angry. Peter has escaped, so two people will take his place. The big question, what has become of Peter? And the guards could only tell the truth. Herod could believe them and acknowledge the entrance of God into the matter or deny their story. And Herod denied their story. To save face, he killed the innocent guards. And what happens in verses 20 through 25 is a clear demonstration of how God defends his people and he protects his holy image. God is a warrior avenging his people. God is a deliverer, and he has a sword by which he will deliver his people. Picking up in verse 20, now Herod was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. With one accord they came to him, and having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they were asking for peace because their country was fed by the king's country. On an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began delivering an address to them. The people kept crying out, "The voice of a god and not a man!" And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and died. But the word of the Lord continued to grow and to be multiplied. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their mission, taking along with them John, who was also called Mark. God alone is deserving of glory. I like that Louis led, to God be the glory. It's perfect. To God alone be the glory. Herod Agrippa was not content in persecuting the church. He wanted more. Just like Herod, the great before him, and just like his father before him, he wanted worship. He was an egomaniac. He wanted to be worshipped. Twice, Luke has spoken of an angel smiting people. One smote Peter and delivered him. Another smote Herod, and Herod died. The angel saved the believer and smote the blasphemer. Pagan people were accustomed to think of rulers as divine. In fact, the next chapter and the following chapter after that, people were trying to worship Paul and Barnabas, and they rejected it. Herod should have followed in their example, but he did not. He accepted it. He wanted to be treated as a god. Herod knew better, but he didn't refuse to accept their idolatry. And this is a signal judgment from God. If he chooses to reserve his vengeance until eternity, it is still true that God will repay all who exalt themselves. But sometimes, God will step in immediately, and he will deal with those who are in opposition to his people, those who are in opposition to his throne. The Jewish historian Josephus talks about the death of Herod Agrippa I, and he says that he was struck by God, and he was eaten from the inside out. And it was miserable. On the one hand was the miserable death of Herod. On the other was the growth of the church. Did you notice that contrast at the end of Acts chapter 12? Luke thus gives us another progress report, and it is encouraging and it is stimulating. He is mentioned several times already in the book of Acts. 3,000, 5,000. It keeps growing. He stops with the numbers eventually. It keeps growing. The word of the Lord continued to grow and to be multiplied. The seed multiplied. And wasn't that the lesson of the parable of the sower? And what happens at the end of this chapter, the tail end, Barnabas and Saul return to Antioch. And in Antioch, they will be sent on the first missionary journey. In Acts chapter 13. Chapter 12 brings to a close the first part of Acts, in which Peter is the major character. He was the one who preached on Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. He was the center stage next to John in Acts chapter 3, or Acts chapter 3, and then 4. And then continuing on, even in Acts chapter 6, he is a clear example of the church there. In Acts chapter 8, we've seen him act. In Acts chapter 9, we've seen him. We see him continuously through the front end of the book. And this verse will transition to the next section of the book of Acts, which will center on the work of Paul the Apostle. We need never fear that Satan will kill the church from the outside. He may kill people, but he cannot destroy the church from the outside. We know God laughs at such feeble efforts. In Psalm 2, it speaks of the kings of the earth rallying together against God's anointed son, and God laughs. He scoffs at them. One thing, though, does have the power to nullify God's influence, and that is the selfish will of people. He invites and he encourages. He extends the gospel to us. He gives a promise for faith and for love and for hope, but he leaves us to decide. Do you want an eternity in heaven, and are you willing to pay the ultimate price to gain it? Is it the pearl of great price that once gaining you may sell and get rid of everything else in the world? The tide is changing, and I don't have any idea, I'm not a prophet, about how fast it will change, but I do know that it's changing. Are you prepared to be faithful until death? That is the big question moving forward in our country. Persecution will start with some, and it will grow. Are you ready? Are you ready to meet your God? In the end of days, every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess. The question is, are you going to do it willingly, or will you be forced to your knees? That is the choice before you this morning. I appreciate everyone who is here this morning. You have a spirit that will live after physical death. Do you want to live in paradise, in God's love for all of eternity, rejoicing and being filled with joy and peace? Or do you want a life of torment because of the wages of your sin? There's one mediator between God and man, Jesus Christ, and it is in his name that we are saved. If you want to be saved this morning, that decision is up to you. God extends freely his grace, but he also tells us to weigh the cost and to count the cost, take up our cross and follow after him. Christianity is no cakewalk, but it is worth it. It is more than worth it. So if you need to make something right this morning, come forward together, we stand and sing.